On June 2, 1972, a traumatized Vietnam War veteran named Roger Holder and his girlfriend Kathy Kirkow hijacked Western Airlines Flight 701 as it approached Seattle. Their plan was to swap the plane's passengers for Angela Davis, who was then on trial for murder, and then to fly to Hanoi as an act of protest against the war. However, through a series of bizarre accidents, they ended up in Algeria with $500,000 in ransom money and the rare distinction of having pulled off the longest distance skyjacking in American history. In a book called The Skies Belong to Us, Love and Terror in the Golden Age of Hijacking, Brendan I. Kerner tells the story of how these two unlikely criminals managed to succeed where so many others failed, and how this act would provide a dramatic climax to a five-year period when a plane was hijacked in American airspace every other week. It's published by Crown. I'm very pleased that it brings Brendan Kerner back to our show. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
The skyjacking most people remember are the ones on 9/11, but during the late 60s and early 70s, didn't they have more of a domestic phase?
Yeah, they really did. It was a period, especially in 69 to 72, when you had planes being hijacked virtually every single week and sometimes two in a day.
Well, did this set in some kind of a panic?
It did to some extent, but at the same time, the airlines didn't want to institute security. The problem at that time was you could walk from the curb to the top of the boarding stairs without ID, without a ticket, with a bunch of dynamite strapped to your chest, and no one would check you. And even though these hijackings were taking place and people were concerned about it, the airlines didn't want to pay the expense of getting metal detectors and the personnel to run them.
And you call, in your subtitle, you call this period the Golden Age.
A little cheeky, yes.
How long after the first skyjacking did the next one take place? Did that set a whole bunch of skyjackings into motion?
Yeah, it was very much an epidemic in that you'd have outbreaks. There'd be clusters of incidents. The first American hijacking was actually in 1961 to Cuba. And then you had four in quick succession that year, and then a reaction, and then another outbreak. So that was the model that it went by.
Were most of them political in nature?
Not really. A lot of people said they had political goals, but usually they came to have personal grievances and often psychological illness as well.
But can we say that they're one of the symptoms of the social unrest of the 50s? I mean, the 60s and 70s?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of people that did perpetrate these hijackings were people like Vietnam veterans, people upset about the decline of the civil rights movement in the early 70s, people upset about a whole range of issues, Puerto Rico's lack of sovereignty. For example, was a big motivation for many people to go to Cuba.
If so many hijackings were happening every year, why were aggressive measures to secure cockpits only made after 9/11?
It's a really good question. I think part of it was that the airlines and the government assumed that all hijackers wanted to negotiate. That was their principal reason for hijacking planes. And so you wanted to give them access to the cockpit so they could talk to the pilots and relay their demands to the ground.
And what tactics did the hijackers employ to gain control of the planes?
There were a whole bunch. As I said, you could bring anything onto a plane. So you had people walking onto planes with machine guns stashed in trombone cases and jars of acid and knives and all manner of weapons. Fake bombs were very popular.
Did the airlines instruct the crews as to what to do if their plane was hijacked?
Yeah, the policy was total compliance. All the airlines wanted was to get their plane back and the passengers to be safe. They were very scared of legal issues. If they had lawsuits, if people got injured or they lost a plane, which was worth millions of dollars, they figured it was much cheaper to let a plane go to Cuba and get the passengers and the plane back safely.
Is that why some of the airlines objected to placing marshals on some of the planes?
Yeah, they were really scared about that. When President Nixon announced the Air Marshals Program in 1970, the airlines thought there might be mid-air shootouts that might puncture a bulkhead and cause a plane to crash.
Well, wasn't that a reasonable concern?
I think it was, yes.
So, but the FBI did suggest that too, didn't they?
Well, the FBI got much more aggressive as this epidemic wore on. You see, starting in 1971 in the summer, you had an incident where a passenger, the first passenger to be killed. And after that, you had the FBI trying many times to use snipers or to send agents in disguise onto planes to end skyjackings with gunfire.
You write that many of these skyjackers, mm-hmm. wanted to go to Cuba. Why Cuba in particular?
There was a time in the 60s when I think a lot of people viewed Cuba as this kind of great proletarian paradise. And I think they honestly thought they would land in Havana and have these fantastic parades in their honor, not realizing that Castro did not want to see them. He was not happy to have these hijackers coming. He stashed most of them in prisons on the southern coast where they could harvest sugarcane.
They were seeking asylum. Did he ever extradite them back?
They ended up doing that eventually. He gave a lot of them, after some time in prison, the option to come back to the U.S. and serve more time in prison here. Eventually, Castro became so infuriated with this epidemic that he actually struck an extradition treaty with the U.S. It was the first one since he'd come to power to get rid of these guys.
Is that why they started hijacking them to Algeria?
That was one of the reasons. I think part of it was that they realized they could. There was a hijacking in 1969, the first one to go somewhere other than Cuba. An Italian-American Marine went to Rome, and all of a sudden hijackers said, wait a second, you'll take me anywhere I want to go?
My guest is Brendan I. Kerner, contributing editor at Wired. He also has worked for the New York Times and Slate, and his latest book is The Skies Belong to Us, Love and Terror in the Golden Age of Hijacking. At the center of this book is the hijacking of Western Airlines Flight 701 by Roger Holder and Kathy Kirkow. They were a radical interracial couple. How had they come to know each other?
Well, it's fascinating because they'd actually crossed paths very briefly as children. She was from Coos Bay, Oregon. And his family, his dad was in the Navy, had been stationed there very briefly in 1959 and actually were run out of town by some racists in the town. And they actually encountered each other at a recreational area very briefly during the Holder's time there.
Well, this is a time of transition in America. Interracial couples were getting married a little more frequently as a result of the 1967 landmark civil rights decision, Loving versus Virginia. But it hadn't been against the law in Coos Bay.
No, it hadn't, but it was a very much a lily-white town. In fact, the Holders were only the second black family in town, and there were some people that were not too happy about their arrival.
And then shortly after he enlisted in the Army, Roger's unit was sent to Vietnam. What was his time there like?
Well, he did four tours in Vietnam, first in an armored unit, and then he was a crew chief on helicopters for a while. Towards the end of his third tour, he was arrested for marijuana possession in Saigon and did about a month in the stockade, and that really made him very bitter about the Army.
And when he came back to the U.S., he went AWOL at one point. It sounds like if we saw him today, we'd say he probably had PTSD.
I think that was a big issue for him. He was injured very badly during his first tour. His armored personnel carrier hit a mine.
Was he engaged in radical politics?
Not really. He had a passing interest. He was a big reader, and he'd read a lot of works about the civil rights movement, but he actually wasn't an active member of any political party.
He seemed to be more fascinated by astrology.
He was very much into astrology, and in fact, that's the thing. When he re-encounters Kathy Kirkow in San Diego, he thinks it must be because the stars have some fantastic destiny in mind for them.
Now, Kathy Kirkow was involved in anti-war protests, but so were a lot of people.
Yeah, sure. That was the thing to do if you were in San Diego in 1971, 1972. That's what you did if you were 20 years old.
When did they begin planning their hijacking?
He began planning it in April 1972. He saw a newspaper item about Angela Davis, who was then on trial, a murder conspiracy trial for her involvement in a shooting at a Marin County courthouse. And something about her and her trial struck a chord in him, and he wanted to liberate her.
And so they decided that they would hijack this plane and go to North Vietnam.
Yes, the plan was to hijack the plane, take it to San Francisco, exchange half the passengers for Angela Davis and a large amount of cash, fly to North Vietnam, drop off Angela Davis and the money with the Viet Cong, and then fly to Australia and homestead in the outback.
Did they have any accomplices?
They didn't. It was just the two of them. But very cleverly, Roger Holder planned to make it seem as he had more accomplices in the back. He claimed to be a member of the Weathermen and said he had some helpers in the back with another bomb.
So the plane takes off. How soon after that do they take over?
Well, they waited a while. It was a Los Angeles to Seattle flight that they were on. And they actually waited until they were about 25 minutes outside of Seattle.
What kinds of weapons did they have?
Holder had what he claimed to be a bomb in a briefcase that had a wire with a copper ring around his index finger.
And then he told the crew that he was being forced to do it by the weathermen.
Yes, he did. He said that the weathermen had kidnapped his wife and children and were holding them.
Did anybody believe that story?
The pilots I talked to said it sounded dubious from the get-go, but again, total compliance. They did what they were told.
So Was there any possibility that Angela Davis would be freed?
Angela Davis was informed about this hijacking as she was having lunch that afternoon. The case had just gone to jury, and she was told that the man she didn't know at all had hijacked a plane and wanted to liberate her. And she said, there is no way on earth I'm going with this man.
Now, Roger really took care of the hijacking. What did Kathy do?
Kathy was supposed to be a lookout. She was supposed to make sure the FBI wasn't going to storm up the rear exit of the plane. That really happened mostly when they landed in New York on the way to Algeria. She actually freaked out at one point, thinking the FBI might storm the plane.
Well, the most dangerous point in any skyjacking is when the ransom money and hostages are exchanged. Often the police will storm the plane. How did they manage to avoid that?
Actually, Western Airlines, specifically the captains involved, were very much opposed to letting the FBI get involved. There had been some recent incidents where the FBI had stormed planes and it resulted in shootings and injuries and deaths of both passengers and skyjackers. And so they basically said, we want the FBI to have nothing to do with this.
Well, how did they wind up going across the Atlantic instead of across the Pacific?
Well, here's the thing. By accident, they hijacked a plane, a Boeing 727, that didn't have the range necessary to get across the Pacific. And so in San Francisco, where they land first, they actually get a new plane. They request a Boeing 720. And for some reason that's pretty much known only to him, Roger Holder took this snafu as a sign he wasn't meant to go to Vietnam. He should go to Algeria instead.
That because that's where a group of Black Panthers, including Eldridge Cleaver, were then living.
That's right. Eldridge Cleaver was there in exile with a bunch of his supporters, living there in the good graces of the Algerian government.
The Algerian military dictator, Houari Boumediene. How were they received in Algeria?
They were granted asylum, but the Algerians, while they were happy to embarrass the U.S., they were a very anti-American regime. They actually confiscated the money and returned it to Western Airlines.
And then Roger and Kathy went to France? Were they treated as celebrities?
They absolutely were. When they were eventually arrested in France in 1975, they became a big cause célèbre for the likes of Jean-Paul Sartre and several movie stars that were very opposed to the Vietnam War and held them up as folk heroes for carrying out this hijacking.
But Roger was put on trial and Kathy disappeared.
She did. While they were awaiting trial, the French refused to extradite them to the U.S. And while they were awaiting trial, Kathy told Roger she was going to Switzerland and he never saw her again.
Do we know if that's what really happened?
We have some evidence that she did indeed go to Switzerland, but the trail does go somewhat cold after that.
And then Roger decides to return to the United States, winds up being arrested.
Yeah, he does. He had twin daughters that were born before he went to Vietnam, and he wanted to reunite with them. He'd had a very difficult time in France.
Now, not all of the skyjackers wound up going to foreign countries. Probably one of the most celebrated skyjackings was the one that was pulled off by the man who has come to be known as D.B. Cooper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of people in 72 especially started jumping out of planes, clutching their ransom. But aside from D.B. Cooper, none of them got away with it. It's very hard to jump out of a plane and get away with it.
But he seems to have gotten away with it. As far as we know, he survived.
Well, most people I talked to said it's quite likely that he's ended up on the top of a 100-foot-tall fir tree and was picked apart by buzzards.
But we don't know.
Well, the fact we don't know makes it an interesting case.
You have any idea why the rash of hijacking suddenly slowed down?
Very clearly. It was because on January 5th, 1973, the airlines finally were forced to screen all passengers. And we got what we have today, where everyone gets checked when they're trying to board an airplane. And almost immediately, hijackings dwindled to zero.
But we've still seen hijackings. And we've seen many instances where people were able to slip things through.
There were always a few during the 70s and throughout the 80s. There was a little spike in the early 80s of Cuban exiles who came over in the Mariela boat lift going back to Cuba. But, you know, after 1991 until 2001, there were no hijackings in America at all.
The FBI actually created a profile to be used in screening passengers to determine if they might be potential hijackers. Yep. Do we know anything about that profile?
We know a little bit. It's actually still secret. In fact, there is precedent saying if it's going to be discussed in a courtroom, the courtroom must be cleared. But I did gather there were things in it such as a failure to make eye contact, a failure to know much about your luggage. These were all tip-offs to ticket agents to ask for a passenger to be screened.
There are some people who just are uncomfortable making eye contact.
Exactly, yes. Very small percentage of those who were screened actually had nefarious purposes in mind.
So what happened if someone fit the profile?
They would be ushered aside very discreetly and swept with a metal detector, but only if they could not furnish valid photo ID.
And were the airlines happy to comply with the FBI's screening regulations?
Well, they were, because it was a much better solution to their mind than making everyone be screened. This was geared to only apply to about half of 1% of travelers.
And they this was a way of not having to go through all the draconian stuff we now go through.
Exactly, yeah.
When you arrive at an airport, the ticketing agent always asks you a series of questions that begin with things like, did you pack your own bags? Mm-hmm. I had an odd experience where I was in Washington and a plane was canceled, and they sent us to another they reticketed us and sent us to a different airport in the Washington area. And because I had had a ticket just issued an hour before, they put me through an incredible screening process.
Right, yeah.
All I hadn't done anything wrong other than have them cancel a plane.
Be unfortunate, right. Yeah, there are all these little tip-offs that are in the system. You know, obviously carrying an item for somebody else. One thing I got some tips on was actually wearing military gear, you know, army jacket, because so many hijackers were Vietnam veterans.
Did most of the hijackers who got to other countries wind up spending time in jail?
Most of them did, not all. Certainly in Cuba, that was the norm. You basically had one of two options, either live in this dormitory in South Havana or be in a sugar-harvesting gulag in the South. The ones who went to Algeria were a little bit luckier.
On the other hand, Roger Holder, by going to France, made himself vulnerable?
He did, but he actually ended up doing very well for himself in France. He ended up living in a huge chateau with a count as his benefactor in the early 80s.
And then didn't go to... But I know of another couple who were imprisoned in France.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were imprisoned briefly. There was certainly this people called the hijacking family that spent some time in prison, but eventually were let go.
Benjamin I. Koerner, Koerner. His book, The Skies Belong to Us, Love and Terror in the Golden Age of Hijacking. It is published by Crown. And I thank you so much for being on our show again.
Hey, thank you for having me.